one could make the argument that disease has always been around. Disease mm-hmm. is protecting ecosystems from becoming overly mm-hmm. off balance exactly. in one area yeah. or another. Mm-hmm. And we're playing God by getting involved and preventing it. Is there any exactly. basis or foundation on that that is worth touching on, or not really? Is it?
Yeah, it looks like disease is one of many factors that has caused evolution, survival of the fittest. And we're seeing with avian influenza that some species aren't affected by it, or they're getting sick, but they're not dying, whereas others, you know, are. So, yeah, very much so. And you could say, you could apply this to all aspects of conservation. How much is too much? You know, we're interfering a lot. And the way that I look at it is, if the cause of decline is something that's been human-induced, then we have a responsibility to mitigate it.
Hello, kia ora, and welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast, brought to you by Conservation Amplified. Our show features the stories of people who are helping nature to bring more awareness to this amazing space. I'm Callum.
And I'm Anna, and today, in today's episode, we're joined by Annie Paget, who is a veterinarian here in New Zealand.
Welcome.
Kia ora.
Thanks. I'm very happy to be here.
So we were really excited to have you on this show. After about 6 months ago, we were lucky to get a scholarship to join Heritage Expeditions to do a cruise around the subantarctic islands. And Annie was one of the awesome staff telling us about it as part of you were doing studies with, was it sea lions there?
Yep.
So that's how we met Annie. Tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
So kia ora, my name is Annie. I grew up in the Otago Peninsula in Dunedin, sharing my backyard with sea lions and albatross. And I think at age 16, I started guiding at the albatross colony down the road and very quickly fell in love with the incredible wingspan of these birds and their regal nature, and everything's, I haven't really looked back since then. Went to vet school, and whilst during those studies, did a lot of extracurricular things in the wildlife space, like being on the conservation board for DOC and doing a lot of work with forest and bird and that sort of thing. And like you guys, I also got the scholarship to go down to the subantarctics. And yeah, that sort of turned my world on my head, and sort of from there, everything I've wanted to do has been to preserve these wild spaces. So once graduating, moved to Tasmania and became a mixed animal, so working with, you know, large animals, cows, horses, and small animal vet. And in the process of working out sort of in a wildlife dense area, we'd get a lot of public bringing in wallabies that had been attacked by their dogs or Tasmanian devils that they'd hit on the road. And yeah, I kind of took up the role of wildlife vet in that clinic. And as much as I loved helping these individual animals, I quickly came a bit frustrated with the limitations of that. I mean, I guess in New Zealand's context, with so many critically endangered species, helping one animal at a time is actually quite beneficial. But I've quickly come to realise that my passion is more addressing things at a species level, figuring out why they're dying and trying to improve conservation strategies and methods to limit the decline of species. And so I came back to New Zealand and took up a role at Massey University in the pathology department as a resident, so kind of furthering my training as a vet to kind of be able to lead mortality investigations in declining species, figuring out why they're dying, whether it be disease or human-induced impacts or something else. And through that, then reporting back to big decision-making organisations like DOC that have the power to change things. So that's currently where I'm at. On the side, I've been doing a little bit of guiding for heritage expeditions, but then sharing, I guess, my knowledge and passion for the areas, but also have become a subcontractor for DOC, doing work with the New Zealand Sea Lions down on the Auckland Islands, looking at mortality in pups, so doing postmortems to figure out if disease is partially the reason as to why they're declining, and if there's any changes in disease patterns, and yeah, helping that space.
It's really cool.
That's fascinating, especially
because... Bit of a long-winded answer.
Especially because the New Zealand sea lion, that's the most endangered sea lion or rarest sea lion species in the world, right?
Yeah. So this past, not this year, this season before, the count that they did on the Auckland, on Enderby Island, which is one of the main breeding locations for these sea lions, they counted 268 pups, which the average in previous years has been around 500. So we're kind of almost halved in the past, you know, 10 or so years. And so that's actually below the threshold for the review through DOC and looking at, because the waters surrounding Enderby Island is a high in the squid fisheries. This is where they met a big fishing area for them. And so if the pup numbers drops below a certain threshold, which it has last year, then it triggers a review, and hence why we're doing a lot more work down there to try and figure out if it is fisheries that is causing this decline or something else. Yeah.
Before we jump into this topic, one of the things I found really interesting when we got the opportunity to visit the Subantarctic Islands was how few people actually know where they are. A lot of people say, "Are you going to Antarctica?" It's like, yeah. No, it's quite a long way from Antarctica. So where are they?
Well, you say, "I'm going to the Auckland Islands," and I think you're talking off, you know, Auckland.
Go to Waikiki.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're actually quite a long way south of Stewart Island. Campbell Island is the southernmost one of the subantarctics at about 700 kilometers from the South Island. And then we come up to, is it Auckland Islands next?
Yeah.
And then there's a few others in there. So the fact that you're spending time working there is actually a long way away from what we think of as Aotearoa, New Zealand. And so
but actually it's one of the most dense in terms of wildlife on our shores. So even though we don't know much about it and it's so far away, it's a hugely important area in terms of conservation, something that we really need to protect because it's a stronghold for so many species. Yeah.
And then as far as like hoiho and the sea lions go, that is their only stronghold really, isn't it? Because they're really rare on the mainland.
If we lose these islands, these species are in huge trouble.
And why is pathology and looking at what happens after the death occurs important?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Conservation in terms of keeping it alive, but it is really a...
Yeah, exactly. Look, I get quite frustrated. I mean, I got frustrated treating animals because I felt like I wasn't having an impact, but I also get quite frustrated because everything I see is dead. And I guess it's from more of a scientific aspect. It's more looking at things retrospectively and seeing trends. And I guess death is obviously the worst outcome. And in terms of decline of species, it's what causes decline. So often with wildlife, we don't see... the lucky few individuals that have been seen sick and that are brought to vet clinics, it's a very much tip of an iceberg. And in terms of disease outbreaks, what we are presented with is a heap of dead animals. We don't often see the before stages. So I guess, unlike, you know, say a cat or a dog, you notice it's, you know, its behaviours, you see when it starts to not, you know, if it's not eating its food, it's looking a bit lethargic, that triggers you to take it to the vet. Whereas with wildlife, we don't see that. We only see the end product. So often analyzing why things are at the end point is the only way to foresee the beforehand and therefore work backwards to bring in these measures to prevent death before it actually happens, if you get what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's different in the wild, right? We don't have that connection like we do for our kitty.
Yeah.
I often think about it as storytelling. Like, they can't talk to us, but if we find them while they're still in a good condition, they can actually tell their story, right? And that can then preserve the species.
Maybe
that's romanticizing it. I don't know, but that's how I like to think about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. So what does the average day look like in Annie Paget's world?
What does my average day look like? It varies a lot. When I'm working on the wildlife roster, I'll get a text in the morning from the Stu, who's the head wildlife pathologist, and he'll tell me what we've got in. So the animals, obviously New Zealand's got a lot of birds, so I deal mostly with birds, and they'll come to us in packages. So the courier drops them off, and we'll get the histories from the submitter, whether it be a dock ranger or a captive rare or that sort of thing, or a rehabber. And then we'll do the post-mortem. So, for example, a few weeks ago we had a kiwi that had fallen into a septic tank, which wasn't fun. And then we had bones of another kiwi that had been found, but we can actually tell a lot of bones. That's another story. Yeah, a kia that had been riding the and I think it was Arthur's Pass, or maybe it was Fiordland, I can't remember, been surfing on the top of someone's car while driving and then fallen off and died, so had a lot of blunt force trauma. And then not too long ago we had a orca come through, a calf that had been separated from its mum and stranded, so we were looking at how effective the method of euthanasia through shooting something through the blowhole, how effective that was and as a euthanasia technique in orca. My days are very variable. There's the post-mortem side of things, but then there's also the report writing and looking through the samples of tissues that we collect and looking at them under the microscope to see if we can find any further lesions. Yeah, so a lot of microscope work, a lot of blood and guts, and a lot of writing up reports. That's mainly what my days comprise of at the moment.
All right. That's it's interesting to think about when we talk about conservation, there's this romanticized notion that we're there planting trees and having a barbecue. And when it comes down to the realities of it, there's a lot of practicalities that aren't quite what you would imagine looking at it from the outside.
I deal a lot with maggots.
I guess wildlife pathology, right? It's a very niche thing, but it's like you already said, it's the learnings that you then can actually go into policy making. That's the fascinating thing about it, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think that's probably more where I'm keen on things versus being too scientific, I really want to have some form of influence or say based off what we're finding to be able to actually see management changes put in place. For example, things like, we know that fisheries are having an impact on sea lions. We just don't know how much. And so if the work I'm doing can help better us understand that and potentially reduce the impact of fishing in those waters, it would be a huge win. Yeah.
For sure. And so it's really interesting that you've gone from the working with living species to realizing that through pathology you can have more of a wider impact through policy, through scientific literature and the foundations that we need to create change. What if I wanted to understand how your work would impact policy, what's the life cycle, I guess? So something happens in the world, it comes to you, and what are the steps that go between there and change taking place?
I guess So yeah, look, like we get we'll take avian influenza, for example. So this is a disease that has been present for quite a while, originated in China and has made its way through the Northern Hemisphere and then down through Mexico into South America quite rapidly over the past few years. And then it's dropped across to South Georgia Island the end of last year, and now has been found also on the Antarctic Peninsula close to South America. So to the current version that we have, or the one that we're concerned about, is called highly pathogenic avian influenza, and it causes very rapid death in birds as well as other species, including marine mammals especially. So elephant seals and fur seals have been really severely affected, with tens and thousands of them dying in South Georgia. It jumps through transmission from scavenging birds eating carcasses of dead animals that have died from the disease. And so then they die, and then it kind of leapfrogs along. So now that it's reached Antarctica, we're concerned that it'll spread throughout the continent with all the penguin colonies along the outside. And then during a certain time of year, the skua, so sort of the scavenging seagulls in Antarctica, they're kind of dark brown. They're very very bold birds, and they're the kind of vacuum cleaners, I like to call them. They come along and scavenge everything that's dead, and then obviously they're quite high risk for avian influenza. And the concern is if they get it, like they have in places like the southern South America and South Georgia and Antarctica, then when they migrate northwards to places like New Zealand, sub-Antarctic islands, they'll bring that disease with them. So it's very scary for our sub-Antarctics. So Enderby, Auckland Islands, Campbell Island, there's a real risk that they will be affected. And the species there, obviously, most of them are birds or marine mammals. So there's a real fear that it will have a devastating impact on especially the sea lions. If in terms of how does that translate into policy, I've just been at a conference for the past 3 days looking at New Zealand's response. What will it be? And so looking at sort of that, being able to, as a vet, to see how things are dying, what species are being affected, how quickly they're being affected, how it's being spread, and be able to report that back to government. And then the government, Ministry for Primary Industries, who usually are the response for in emerging diseases, then they can make changes, or it's kind of like the COVID response, really, make these big decisions based off recommendations from people that understand disease processes and how it impacts species. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then once the policy's made, then resources are allocated to
further research,
information.
And things like vaccinations, trials, shutdowns of movement from islands. The issue with avian influenza is it's transmitted from birds that fly.
Right.
So it's not like you can, unlike COVID, where we could shut the borders, we can't do that. We can't stop birds from coming here.
Right.
So we are pretty limited in what we can do on that front. But it's more how can we best protect our species so that the impact is as minimal as it can be. Yeah.
And I think it's important to note just how serious this is actually taken. When we were on the Heritage Expedition's voyage in the sub-Antarctics with yourself and the team, the amount of biosecurity precautions that we had to go through just to leave the boat was absolutely insane, and really good that it was there, but it was quite eye-opening to see even the last little seed or a little bit of twig on your zip of your jacket from a year ago that you forgot about
was
getting plucked out. And
It's all very fragile, isn't it? And in the avian influenza, it'll be all about early detection, right?
Exactly. So this most recent trip we to the subantarctics, we were actively testing albatross and skua, so these pesky like subantarctic seagulls, and petrels as well. So we were testing them by doing a swab of their mouth and their bum, and yeah, then sending that back to MPI to make sure. So just yeah, they were all negative, obviously, but yeah, we're just wanting to have this active surveillance for early detection. Same thing for anything that comes through the post-mortem service at Massey. So anything that's died of neurological signs or clinical signs that is consistent with avian influenza, then we'll do tests to make sure to rule it out that it's not that. Yeah.
Mm.
And in terms of what you were saying about, yeah, on the boat, so the heritage expeditions, so every time passengers were going to these different islands, they'd be stepping into this Vircon foot wash, so stopping if there were any viral particles on there, killing them before you get onto the island. Same thing, there were rules that you couldn't put your backpack down on the ground or sit down, so if you were to sit in bird poo and then go elsewhere and put your bag down again, then you're not spreading it as much, trying to limit the impact, like you say.
Is this, oh, sorry, you go.
No, you go.
is this type of biosecurity and research something that should or is only limited to really remote areas like Antarctica and the subantarctics? Or as the environment becomes more fragile going forward, do you see the need for these types of precautions and research becoming more widespread?
Oh, definitely. Climate change particularly is quite worrying because as temperatures rise, things like mosquitoes come further south, and they're very well-known vector for disease transmission. So, for example, in the Hoiho, we're seeing increased rates of avian malaria, which is transmitted, it's a blood-borne parasite that's transmitted through mosquitoes. So yeah, as the conditions get warmer, the mosquitoes are going further south, and then that disease is spreading as well. So that's just one of many examples where emerging diseases is becoming more and more and more of an issue.
Right. I guess if we zoom out, the blending of all these different ecosystems and habitats that would have evolved with their own niches for so many millions of years.
Yeah.
Now that's not
the case. This isn't, diseases, they've always been here. They're constantly evolving. It's just more, like you say, the human aspect of us mixing things and causing some certain species to flourish and others to be, like, for example, a lot of New Zealand species are very immunocompromised due to such a bottleneck effect where there've been such low numbers and then inevitably a bit of inbreeding, and therefore we're getting this very, just very vulnerable individuals. And that's why we're so worried about things like avian influenza, because they're just not designed or not equipped to deal with it. So there's no way of saying how things like avian influenza will impact these species, because again, they're so different to many of the other bird species in the world, we can't really compare. Kiwi out in the northern hemisphere, so it's very hard to predict what will happen.
But as a devil's advocate, one could make the argument that disease has always been around. Disease is protecting ecosystems from becoming overly off balance in one area or another. And we're playing God by getting involved and preventing it. Is there any basis or foundation on that is worth touching on, or not really? Is it?
Yeah, look, like disease is one of many factors that is caused evolution, survival of the fittest. And we're seeing with avian influenza that some species aren't affected by it, or they're getting sick but they're not dying, whereas others are. So yeah, very much so. And you could say, you could apply this to all aspects of conservation. How much is too much? You know, we're interfering a lot. And the way that I look at it is, if the cause of decline is something that's been human induced, then we have a responsibility to mitigate it or do as much as we can. So for example, you know, invasive predators in New Zealand, this was caused by us. Therefore it's on us to be doing all this, you know, trapping and 1080 and all that sort of thing. You know, so I guess, yeah, it's kind of a lot of disease, really. It's inevitable. We can't stop it. And especially with avian influenza, I'm quickly accepting that there's nothing we can do to stop it, and there's nothing we can do once it's here. But if we can have a plan for our species that have been so low in numbers due to us, then, yeah, we have a role to play.
Yeah, I can definitely, I love what you just said with, you know, our responsibility, where we as humans cause that decline. And it's like you said, we can't just shut our borders against disease, but what we can do is prepare ourselves and of course find out better management tools, right?
Yeah.
For the things that we did cause.
Yeah.
I guess that leads into a really good question, which is a lot of what we've spoken about is outside of the public's eye. It's scientists, it's conservationists, it's policymakers and government. But as an individual, what are some practical things that you can actually do to help with these areas, that you can do to help with preventing disease spread or making sure that you're not interfering in a negative way?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if we're looking at it from a disease perspective, especially as avian influenza becomes more and more of a threat, you can be looking while you're out walking on beaches or out in the environment if there is any particular animal that, whether it be bird or marine mammal or whatever, that is looking sick or having neurological signs or, heaven forbid, is dead, then you can report it. So there's the 0800.hop line, which is you can call at any time, and to report any dead animal or if you're concerned about avian influenza, then it's something that you should report. And yeah, whether or not they take it further, it's up to them, but as an individual, that's something that you can be having impact on. Reading up about the issue is a big one. So, and raising awareness amongst your peers is important. And then exposing yourself to these special places so that you can then advocate for them. So the True Young Explorer Scholarship, which we have all done, is a very valuable, eye-opening opportunity to kind of, you know, develop an emotional connection with these special places and share it with others and propagate that throughout our community so they're more and well known, and especially with things like the Fast Track Bill and Shane Jones and all that, if we can put as much pressure on them as possible to advocate for these places, then that's a huge impact you can be having.
Yeah, I think like what's going on is really devastating. At the time of our recording, as far as the Fast Track Approvals Bill, but I think it's a symptom of a deeper condition that, in many ways, as we've developed as a species, we've lost our connection with nature that was there so much more in the past. And that was one thing that really came out of the trip to the Subantarctics was reconnect with nature, to appreciate these wild places.
I guess that's something I've struggled with a bit, because having been down to the Subantarctics with Doc and lived on these islands without seeing how the animals are every day, and then also seeing the impacts of tourism and how their behaviour changes, I sometimes question where ecotourism sits in all of this. But then having been on the other side of it and seen having created these situations where people can develop that emotional connection and realize within themselves how important these wild places are, and have that, you know, I've, so many people I know have then gone to change their career paths or, you know, stuff like that, that is hugely impactful.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, exposing people to these places is, does so much more than watching a documentary or reading a news article. And I think it's the single most important way to change the societal mindsets that we're in. And if we could get, you know, all of our politicians on a boat down to the subantarctics, maybe we wouldn't be having the issues that we're having.
There's other play for a job on that.
It's just, it's really cool to see the transformations over those, you know, short time down there of people at the start and at the end, and seeing, you know, people cry when an albatross flies over their head. And, you know, it's just such a powerful and empowering space to be in, and that I think ecotourism plays a huge role in, you know, the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis when done right. Yeah.
Yes. I think there's a fine, very fine line on that, which is a whole different topic. But, you know, you saying you grew up near Dunedin, but that's, to me, that's a spot where you don't necessarily have to go as far as the subs. Like, start off small, like go to the peninsula. Exactly. And appreciate what's there, right? And we could probably have more of that in New Zealand if we wanted to encourage and nurture their environments, right?
That's my goal, is to make the mainland of New Zealand like the subantarctics. If we could have, even if just a small teaspoon of the subantarctics, or this, you know, wildlife that doesn't fear you, or, you know, deafening bird song when you're walking through those rata forests, like it's, you know, something very, it's something to strive to.
And it's already happening, right? Because we now have recordings of the sea lions breeding on the South Island again, and that's fairly recent, isn't it?
Yeah. We're crossing our fingers. We're pretty close to being able to call the Otago, or the South, you know, Catlins and Otago, you know, Otago Peninsula coastline a colony in itself. So we can just bump those pup numbers up a little bit. That would be amazing. Yeah.
It's so awesome. But at the same time, if we don't go out to have a connection with wildlife, whether it's going all the way to the subs or to Antarctica, bless you, or if it's going to your backyard, whether that's Otago Peninsula, whether you're living in Auckland Central and you go out to Piha or to the Waitakere Ranges, it's still an intention to go and do it. And I think, you know, there's been this notion in people's minds of we need to separate conservation from industry, and we need to separate you know, conservation is about going and having this duty to help. But in many ways, it doesn't have to be some kind of job or duty or responsibility as much as just growing in yourself. Because when you experience that wildlife, you do become it grows something within you. And I think without that, that's the foundation that you need to actually have the will to protect wildlife and to help nature.
Yep. It's that whole kaitiakitanga, hey? But not ownership, but guardianship. And you need to know what's out there and develop that connection with it to be able to take that further. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. That's the big thing. If people care, they're so much more willing to do something. But if you can show them, then they might care even more.
Mm. It was interesting. During my vet studies, I spent some time in South Africa, doing work with dehorning rhino for prevent poaching crisis and that sort of stuff. And over there you can own wildlife, which was a really weird concept to me, but you're perfectly within your own right to go and buy a block of land and then go buy a giraffe or pride of lions or that sort of thing. And to me, it was like, that's everything I hate about capitalism and that sort of thing. But at the same time, if you own it, then you're more likely to take care of it. So, yeah, it was an interesting concept and not something I'd maybe completely agree with. But, you know, the wildlife numbers are doing better since that has been put in place. So, yeah.
It's so interesting. There's no one way that you can do conservation, right?
Like, no, there's, yeah. There's definitely so many extremes, and I'd call that an extreme.
Yes. But, yeah, great.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I guess, really leads on to a final question on this call, and which is...
Yeah, what does conservation mean to you, Annie?
What does it mean to me? I guess, yeah, it's leaving the world in a better place than when you came into it. Yeah,
I feel like you're living that. I'm trying to, Are we all trying to, right?
That's a bit of a depressing space that I'm in, but yeah, you see the goods come out of it too, and it makes it worth it. Yeah.
Oh, this has been such a fascinating, eye-opening conversation. I'm really so grateful to have you here.
Thank you for joining us.
No worries.
Yeah, really.
But yeah, if anyone wants to reach out, I've got a website called Green Eggs, so you can reach me on there. Yeah.
Green, how do you spell that? Sorry? Green.
Green, GREENANGEST.com. Yeah.
Okay, awesome. And what will people find on your website? Is it?
A mixture of... you know, I do a bit of a report bit on the sea lion stuff that I've done, and a lot of photos and wildlife content on there. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Greenangst.com. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Awesome. Cool. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Keep up the amazing work. Yes. It's really cool.